Hey there, everybody. This is Maya Anika, visual artist and mental health advocate and speaker of the Spectrum blog, here with Stephanie at the Dope Science Show. And you should be here too. Go Steam!
Yeah!
Okay, this is Jay Banks, and I've been on a Dope Science Show with the dopest girl I've ever known in my life, San Diego. And her name is, say it again,
Science Steph with Steph.
Science Steph with Steph. That's right. She's a great lady, guys. I hope you tune into her show.
My name's Damien Swaby, and I'm here on the Dope Science Show, the best podcast out there today.
Hello, welcome to the Dope Science Show with Stephanie, or Science Steph with Steph. This is episode 6, and I'm super excited because we get to talk to a neuroscientist, one of my favorite genres or realms of science is neuroscience and quantum physics. So I'm really excited about this. I took questions from online via Twitter and Instagram, so she answered some of those questions. She talks about how she became a neuroscientist and what inspires her. I can't talk today. And did you like her music choice? It was very eclectic, I would say. All right, now, so let's start the show.
Well, welcome to the Dope Science Show, Natasha. Say hello.
Hello.
Yep, and for my audience, this is Natasha Wadlington. Is that how you say your name?
Yep, Wadlington. Mm-hmm. That is correct.
Yeah. She is a neuroscientist and super awesome, works with the community, sharing science with students and just everyday people. She makes what sounds very complicated, she makes it sound in understandable, in a very easy, digestible way. She makes complicated science sound easy. I think that's a good way to say it.
Digestible and consumable for all audiences.
Definitely. So, can you give us a little bit idea of who you are and what you do?
Mm-hmm. So I'm Natasha Watlington. I'm a neurobiologist by training. I wasn't always a neurobiologist. I started my science career actually in general biology, studying plants and looking at how different plants migrated into areas in the Northwest, in the Pacific area, Pacific Northwest. And at that time, my mom was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. So mm-hmm. At that point, I kind of shifted gears and focus more on neurodegeneration. So I went into a Parkinson's disease focus lab where I went to study all the different mutations that can affect Parkinson's disease and see if we can like figure out what was going on. So I did that up until 2013 where I got the PhD.
And wow. Now, and then once you get a PhD in
neurobiology, so I found a little link between Parkinson's and stroke. So that paper got published, I think, a year or two ago. And so since then, I did a little more work with cerebral palsy models in mice, and then I went on to go to the museum where I'm at currently.
Well, that's isn't it funny how you'll start in one way, but if you keep an open mind, you'll just meander wherever you're supposed to be, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You started with
exactly.
Plant biology, and through the, you know, the luck of life, Parkinson's came into your focus.
Mm-hmm.
Has it been beneficial with your mom as far as being able to be an advocate for her?
I mean, it helped. It gives more awareness out. I mean, she passed away in 2010, right in the middle of my dissertation. But that kind of still gave me that strength and motivation to keep it going because, like, people should figure out these things. We want to, like, I mean, it's hard to get cures, but if we understand a disease better, people could mm-hmm. have, like, a longer lifespan, a better life, just a general understanding of how things are working. So, of course, I'm, like, all for that.
Definitely. I understand that. And you said you're now in Chicago. Mm-hmm. What are you doing in Chicago?
So I was actually born and raised here in Chicago, and mm-hmm. so I wanted to, like, I've always been into science, like the first things I've learned about science was, like, you remember those old world encyclopedias, like the big 18 volume stacks. My mom got those.
Britannicus?
Yeah, that was like one of the sets, and another set was the World Encyclopedia. So that I used to read as a kid. So I would go up to my mom. Was like, "Oh, look! I just learned the biggest, like, smallest bones in the body." She'd be like, "Which one is that?" It's like, "The biggest one is the femur, and then the little ones are the hammer, the anvil, and the stirrup." And she would like actually tell her friends that I got that information. And it was just mind blowing. Like, I was like, what, five? Like, why am I learning about the bones like that? So, like, it's been in my blood for a long time to, like, deal with the body, deal with science. So it just kind of came out naturally, I guess, for me.
Well, that's like, good. Did you have did you have any mentors or anyone you looked up to growing up that kept you in science? Like, you know, you're kind of not – it wasn't necessarily cool to be a scientist growing up, back
correct.
In the day.
Yeah, like the biggest turning point was probably when I transferred schools. In second grade, I went to a school called Marty Skinner, and they had a science, like, class part for the curriculum. Because I went to Catholic school before that, and they didn't have any of that. It was just the regular, like, math, reading, whatever. But when I got to that science class, not only did I have a teacher that was teaching that stuff, but she was a teacher that looked like me.
Aww.
So that kind of blew my mind away. It was like, oh, this is kind of cool. And then I had that, but my uncle, he was like a huge, like, sci-fi person, sci-fi geek, science lover. So he helped me with, like, some of those projects that I did in the classroom. And that kind of, like, solidified my thinking. I was like, I want to do this. Like, this is kind of cool.
So seeing people who look like you know, and having someone who is an adult, someone you could relate to who was into it as well, just supported you in your enthusiasm.
Yeah, that triggered it. And then my mom, she didn't deny me. Like, she gave me not only my Barbies, but she gave me, like, the Ninja Turtles science kits. I mean,
I didn't know they had a Ninja Turtle science. Wow.
Oh, it's a different kit. She gave me, like, different stuff. So it wasn't just limited to just Barbies and cooking and stuff. She actually believed in me doing what I wanted. So if I want a Ninja Turtle, I play with Ninja Turtles. If I wanted a Barbie, I play with Barbie. If I want a science kit, she gave me that science kit because she knew, I guess, back then, how important it is to, like, give people of all ages, all genders, like, some kind of influence, like, let it grow what they like. And she did that for me, which it shaped my life, because it's like I had encouragement to do science. I had encouragement to, like, mix her $100 perfume with eggs, which she didn't like at the time, but she didn't stop me from experimenting, so it was cool.
That was awesome. That's kind of what I do with my daughter. I'm like, okay, well, just as long as you clean it up, like, that's pretty much my motto. I'm like, okay, whatever, because I feel like just learn everything, and then, you know, you never know where that's going to take you.
Exactly. That's the kind of stuff we teach at the museum where I'm working at now. It's like, we want everybody to get involved, kids, adults, like, younger. Oh, we don't care. It's like,
What is the name of your museum?
Museum of Science and Industry.
In Chicago.
Yep, in Chicago.
So what do you guys do there? Is it, like, hands-on applied science?
Yeah, we have hands-on things that range between the sciences, technology, engineering, and medicine. And math is incorporated in all four of those things, so that's why we don't necessarily say the math part, but it's in there too. So we have different exhibits based off of those, like, branches. So we have like our new thing, the brick by brick exhibit, that's where we have Legos, where kids not only get to look at different structures in Legos, like the Golden Gate Bridge, we got Cinderella's Castle, but they can also learn how to develop their own engineering. So they make, like, paper bridges, or they make, like, architecture buildings from themselves to see, like, if they can survive an earthquake or, like, a wind tunnel. We have that kind of stuff. And then we have another section where we have, like, you the experience. So you can actually see, like, the parts of the brain and the body. And they get to, like, interact, see how fast their heart's beating. We got a mind ball machine where if you relax, you can move that ball with your mind.
Oh, what?
So it's kind of like interactive things. Yeah, it's you can see how like crazy people get over that exhibit. It's amazing. Completely
that is amazing.
Amazing.
I would love to go there and play with the mind machine. I'm like, I want to make it move, you know?
Yeah, that's one of the favorites.
I bet it is. Oh, if you were to say, what is your dream, like, goal in your science career? Like, if you could, like, you know, where would you want to be, you know, as far as where your career goes? What would you like to see?
Yeah, I actually want to do more science communication. I have forgot about this part when I was in grad school, like, throughout the whole process with the studying of my mom. One of the things I wrote before I went to grad school is not only did I want to be a scientist, but I also want to take that knowledge and drop it to everybody in this Chicagoland community. Like, everybody should know that we are all scientists. We ask questions, we figure out if things worked. If they didn't work, we try it differently. That's what everybody does, and we have to understand that we use STEM in our everyday lives. So I want to get out there and, like, explore that and, like, try to get the word out about that concept. That's what I want to do.
Well, you're doing it. That's exactly what I want to do. I'm not a scientist. Well, I am. I am a dope scientist. It's my whole thing that we're all dope scientists. We just have to find our niche and be aware of what we're doing and what's around us. And what you're saying is exactly, you know, my dream. Wouldn't it be wonderful if everyone, like, was more open and critically thinking about things? You know, and they didn't feel afraid of science. Did you feel any sort of isolation going through your educational career? You know, did you see any other women of color or other people of color? How did you deal with that?
Yeah, so there's always going to be that issue just because the pipeline, as they say, is very, very leaky. And the higher up you go, the more leaks you're going to get. So, I mean, even though at some times I might have been the only person, or there may be two of us that was in the classroom, at least we were still there. I mean, some people before me couldn't even get that benefit. And so we start to form our networks where we're talking to people. We go to, like, a conference called AmberCams where we get a whole bunch of, like, minority students. SACNAS is another one where you get a lot of minority students, and they can talk about their science, learn how to play the game. And so that you build this kind of network to support each other, which is important. And then you also have the allies. They're also helping us, too. Everybody wants more diversity because the more diverse you're going to be, the more ideas you're going to get. And that's critical for the sciences and the STEM technology, everything like that. That's critical. And so we're trying to promote that more. And it's getting better with the years, but we still got a lot of work to do.
Cool. So I know that I was stalking you online and I saw that you have a blog that you've been on and off for a few years now, and looks like, you know, you've been very involved with networking. So I'll follow up with you to add to the show notes, like, any organizations or networks or allies, resources that I can add. Cause, you know, a lot of people that I talk to, the reason why they're not in science or never really considered it is simply didn't see anyone who looked like them, didn't want to be alone, just was not in their, you know, their horizon of possibilities, you know?
Definitely know that.
You know, that is the number one reason why I hear people are not into science. Actually, a lot of people are into science. They just didn't know that they could be engaged in it. You know, what was I going to ask you? So do you have any special events or projects or anything that you'd like to promote for Chicago or in a convention or anything that you have coming up?
Let's see. Well, I'm with the Illinois Science Council, which is a nonprofit group that tries to promote science and STEM with adults in the Chicagoland community. So a lot of the programs are focused towards, like, little kids or, like, teenagers. But this is more geared towards, like, the adult thing. So we have, like Pi Day runs. So, like, on March 14th, we have, like, math thing, like, 5Ks or Pi Ks, as we call it sometimes. where you just get around some science facts. We also have this science of a cocktail party coming up. What was that?
That sounds awesome. I would love to go like to an adult, you know, event and where we drink and then talk science.
Yeah, I mean, you could actually do science experiments at this event.
Ooh,
like they have
really?
Like mind experiments. They have like tricks of the light. They have a lot of stuff that you. It's not just drinking and listening. We want you to interact. And
right.
We want you to participate. That's how people like to learn. And so we follow that philosophy too, where we get people involved. So they not only get their drink on, but they also get their science on too, which is very cool. This is what that program wants to do. We have like chemistry of chocolate series, chemistry of beer. So they figure out how this stuff is made, but at the same time, they get a little treat after.
Very, very cool.
It's pretty cool.
Are you an organizer or you're just a participant who's like super hyped about it?
I'm part of the associates board. So that's like the second board under the executive board that helps either organize some of the stuff or like kind of promotes it. We occasionally will like help out with some of the events itself and try to get like the word out. We got a blog that's out where you can also ask the scientists and be like, hey, like, how does this work? And then you get like a little like blog form of saying like, this is what it does. So it's a lot of involvement. It's still up and coming, but it's pretty cool so far. I've been there, I think, 1 or 2 years. It's been a few years, so it's a nice change of pace.
I'm gonna have to follow up with you on that because that would be like a cool thing to do with, you know, the Dope Science Show, like having a meetup event or something like that where we get to do science experiments. That would be really cool.
Yeah. Totally fun. Yeah. I like doing that kind of stuff.
Definitely. I've never my chemistry class, I took chemistry as an adult, and then we got to do science experiments, but never outside of a lab, really. So that would be cool.
Yeah, there's
that'd
a
be
lot
really
of
cool.
places. Like, they have, like, all the museums in Chicago, or at least a lot of them, have these adult after dark kind of parties where you talk about science stuff or you get to explore the museums and or the zoos in a more not so children involved, but it's more like adult involved. And you have those like serious conversations. And it's like, I think that's the way to go in the future to get more people involved.
I think so,
in
too.
It.
Because,
yeah,
you know,
cool.
The adults will share it with their children, you know?
Exactly.
Simple as that.
It's cool to have focus on the kids, but it's also cool to not leave adults out too, because they're the ones that's going to immediately have an impact.
Right, exactly. So that's how my show. I mean, kids can listen, but I really want to be able to talk about anything, you know, and not censor because I have kids listening, you know. So I'm like, sure, listen in, but definitely, it's for. I just want people like you and myself and other, you know, grown-ups to be engaged with science as well and not think of it as just, oh, that was back in the school days. That was, you know.
Yep.
I had some cool questions that I tweeted you that I asked people this morning. Did you want to go through any of them that piqued your interest?
Let's see. There was a few. Let's see. So So that first one that you sent was whether the telepathy or telepathy. Tomato,
oh, yeah.
Tomato.
I don't know if I spelled that.
Yeah, it's spelled right. It's just sometimes there's nuances depending on where you grew up, how to pronounce it. If that's possible, telepathy, there we go, is possible.
Yeah.
And from the standpoint of how our technology is right now, I would say not right now. It's nowhere close to being possible, but there was a study that did come out where they kind of tricked the system, if you will, where they had someone read their brain waves using a EEG machine. And so it picked up the patterns of their brain waves, and then they converted that into like ones and zeros, so it became like a computer signal, sent that like overseas to another person, and then had those like signals put on their brain or put on their head so that it shot those signals out to their brains. And so they were being able to see like I think they said a splash of color or brightness or something.
What?
In their periphery, where they like kind of decoded like Morse code.
Oh.
So it's not telepathy per se, like you just stare at somebody to get your message. But it is like a communication where, I mean, this is very primitive. That's like only two studies, I think, that's been done. But, I mean, maybe something could get developed that way where you like have a, I don't know if you have a chip or an implant or something.
Oh.
Where they could maybe send messages like that. Like if I had to do it, I would get like two people who like, kind of study the same thing and see where the parts in their brain light up similarly, take those similarities, put that into a signal, and then have them, like, communicate that way from far away, because then you're hitting the same area so that they would know, like, if I said hi, your brain lights up, you send that signal, and then the other person can translate it or read it. It's like, okay, that person said hi, so they just said hi to me.
Right.
I would do it that way, but that's, like, far-fetched, still kind of sci-fi-ish.
That's cool, though.
Like,
hey,
you can,
sci-fi,
I mean, you can
often
imagine
becomes
it.
Reality.
That's true. Like, a lot of Star Trek stuff is now our reality.
Exactly.
Except for the teleportation. We still haven't got that yet.
But we're getting close with the holograms. I'm like, I feel like we're getting closer with virtual reality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would probably put more money on that than the telepathy right now. I know they
Speaking
had, like,
of,
that Tupac concert, and I was like, whoa.
I know. If I change my perspective and think about it from science, sure, I'll go see Tupac as a hologram. But my heart doesn't want to see that. I don't know. I don't want to see that. But I just don't want to see it. I don't know if he would like that.
Kind of like a ghost almost, like, ah.
Yeah, like I'm like, I just don't want to see that. It just doesn't seem right. But from a scientific perspective, I could see that being cool. Like, okay, we've reached a level of technology. Yay! You know, so I could see it from that perspective, definitely. Speaking of virtual reality, you play Pokemon Go, and you're into it. And it was hugely popular. And why do you think it was so popular so quickly? Why did it go viral? What do you think?
Well, first, I mean, you got a lot of people for the last 20 years that have been playing Pokemon, or at least heard of it.
Right.
So, one, you have that nostalgia factor, which that just triggers everybody's heartstrings. And then you got the effect of like, oh, what are they doing over there? Like, I want to play that. What's going on? So you got that kind of like curiosity, kind of like following the crowd a little bit.
Right.
So that, I think, is another factor. And then, two, it's freaking Pokemon outside in the real world. It's like, you can take pictures and, like, you're like, hey, I got a Pidgey on my shoulders. Like, what's up? It's like, that is a novelty because we don't experience that, like, seeing real-life cartoon characters or whatever, like, popping into your reality. That's, like, a fantasy probably for a lot of people. And so,
definitely.
I mean, I liked it because I'm like, dude, look, did you see that primate? It's like, it's right there, straight there. Actually, I'm going to play today with my roommate and our friend because we like doing that stuff. And it gets us out. I mean, that's like one of the most beneficial things of it. Not only do you get to like exercise, but you also socialize it. Like, I'm an introvert. I don't like talking to that many people. I'm just surprised I can do my job. But it gets me out. And it's like, I met new people that I would never have met in my community if I didn't play that game. Now I know they exist. It's cool.
See,
so not
I'm
only
like,
you got the social stuff. That's cool.
Right. I need to get in it. Like, the reason why I haven't is only because it's like I was interested, but something, I don't know, it just seemed, I'm an introvert too, and so I was just like, this is going to be a lot of going out. Like, I don't think I like it, but I'm like, I don't know, I just didn't want to get addicted to it. That's more why I didn't want to play. And I asked my friend, because I said, you know, he's a Pokemon fanatic as well, and a gamer, a hardcore gamer, and he's into it with his kids. And I asked him, what question would you want to ask, you know, my dope neuroscientist friend? And he said he thought that it went viral for all the same reasons that you mentioned, as well as it being, you know, a direct, like, reward system, like, thing. Like, it's constantly like dopamine, you know, like oops, I got it. Like, he compared it to playing those like gambling games online, like, you know, worth what are those
it
called?
Could have some, I mean, there's the, for the dopamine pathway, you actually have, there's several pathways in the brain. The reward system is one, and so that can be accurate. It's also like positive. If you do something new or something novel, you'll get a little spike of dopamine. So it's like, hey, that feels good. I like that. Like, let's try it again. Let's see if it happens. So that's kind of like that reward system. Now, the other half of that is with the Parkinson's, which is, we aren't 100% sure if that does have some overlap, but that's more like a movement system. So there are different spots in the brain that use like a lot of the same chemicals. It just might give different outcomes. So that could
that
be the novelty of the Pokemon game. It's like, hey, it's like, I just caught something. I've never seen that in my life. Let's keep going. So, yes, I would say he has a good view of that as well. It's just like it's instant gratification. Or if we're learning now is that once they did that little update for their servers where you start getting less Pokemon and more of the quote-unquote crappy ones, people stop playing it. They didn't get that reward anymore. So it's like, it's a two-way street. It can help or it can hurt. And they actually do experiments like that with the mice in the lab, where they can tell, like, the threshold of tolerance if their reward system is still, like, intact. Like, if they get too many, like, lever presses and they don't get no food or nothing, they, like, forget this. I ain't doing it no more. But with those mice that have problems with that system, they keep going until it's, like, not healthy for them. And so that's all neurobiology right there. There's, like, tons of papers. Not my direct field, but there's a lot out there that you can study about that.
Very
Maybe that's why Pokemon Go is good.
That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it's fun, you know, and that's good. I'm not going to hate on it. Just was thinking, I like to peel back the layers on everyday, you know, things or trends.
Yeah.
Did you have any, there were a couple other questions. Were there any other ones that you want to jump in on?
Yeah, let's see. Checking that right now. The one that made me actually think was that what has a greater influence, the mind or the heart on the body?
Oh, yeah.
Like, for a second, like, just from my background, I'm like, oh, I know the answer. But then I'm like, wait a second. Like, you can look at this question two different ways, and you can kind of go out of the box with that. So I had to sit down and think. And I was like, all right, let's two scenarios that could happen here. So we're just talking, like, strictly, like, pure physical body. Like, you could have most of your mind gone as long as you keep that brain stem, like, at the base of your neck, the little part down there, the most primitive part in our heads. If you keep that, your body can still technically live. Because that area controls, like, the diaphragm for breathing. You got the heart. It controls the heart for the beating and stuff. You can live like that. I mean, you may not have a conscious or anything. But, like, physical body, that's possible. Then I reverse that. It was like, can someone live without a heart or without a heart? And there are ways. I mean, we have heart transplants, and there are some people that got hooked up on a machine without the heart that still survived, like an operation or something. So I think it's more possible for you to survive without the heart, at least with the technology that we have right now. But it might not be possible for you to survive with the mind, because that pretty much controls everything.
Mm.
So I'm more pro-mind just on that kind of approach of, like, substitution.
I can see that. Huh. That's, you know, that's a good answer. I mean, so basically, we could live without a heart because we can have an artificial heart. Does that count?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you have an artificial heart, that might be a temporary fix. Where people have survived with that, at least for a short period of time. I don't know how long people have lived without a heart. I think
but
I heard something not
brain.
Too long ago. Yeah, you need your brain. If you want to be you, you're going to have your brain. So you can have the brainstem part of it, but you're losing all of the consciousness and everything else in the higher, like, more complex parts of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where it comes out, like, what do you define as a body? Is it just, like, the physical body? Then, yes, that can survive without a brain, as long as you get that little piece there. Or if it's, like, you as a conscious body, then, no, you need your brain for that.
That brings me to the next question. Someone asked, actually, she's a neuroscientist as well, or studying, well, I guess she is, yes. And she asked, how do you think we'll ever be able to quantify consciousness?
Mm-hmm. So that's a little bit of a tricky question, but some people mm-hmm. are trying to work on that right now. So I just saw, like, I did an online search a few hours ago where people looked at consciousness by studying how the cells actually use their metabolism. So in the brain, well, throughout your whole body, you need sugar to, like, survive, like glucose specifically for the most part. So they looked at the activity of those brains to see either in the people that were conscious, people that was in, like, in a semi-state of consciousness, like people in comas, versus people mm-hmm. that, like, clinically brain dead. And so they took, like, a radioactive type of sugar, radioactive glucose, stuck that in the people's bodies, and then see how much their brain was using it as fuel. And what they found out was that the people who were, like, conscious, like, alive, pretty much fine, their whole brains were starting to light up.
Mm.
People that were in that, like, semi kind of state, it reduced by, like, I think 40% or something like that, but there was still activity. But in the people
okay.
that were clinically brain dead, there was, like, almost nothing. So in a general
okay.
sense, yes, you can detect some kind of consciousness, at least it's possible. But as far as, like, what part does what, who knows?
Yeah.
This is just now starting, so.
How interesting.
But I would say it's some possibilities at least. Like, if you're in a coma, like, sometimes you have those comas where you can hear people, but you just can't move.
Mm-hmm.
So that might be a tool where doctors can say, like, okay, their brain is, like, still pretty active. They're not brain dead.
Oh.
They just can't get to that consciousness state yet. And so maybe it's possible. It's like, you don't want to pull the plug on someone like that because that's going to be tragic. But
oh.
if you have a tool that you can develop, it's like, hey, there's still, like, something's going on here. That
right.
made me say, like, okay, they have better chances of survival. Let's try to work with something.
Right. And they use the radioactive glucose because they can use tools to measure the radioactivity, so it makes it visible. It's like almost like having a dye that they insert
yeah.
into your body. Yeah.
Yeah, I think they call it a PET scan, PET, where they
yes.
can pick up that radioactivity. So, I mean, that would be a very nice tool if we can, like, get it done. I think they had, like, 100 and some people, like, with the experiment, which is pretty good for, like, a people experiment, because
mm-hmm.
it's just hard to get that many people on board for something like that.
Yeah. Well, that's very interesting. What
yeah.
other question did I have? Someone said, do you think there'll ever be a cure for Alzheimer's, and where do you think it'll come from?
Hmm. Yeah, that is the big question. It is very, very complicated. Like, as of right now, I will always say that there is a possibility, but we're not anywhere near there yet. Because a lot of the problems with, like the neurodegenerative diseases, or even like the brain injuries, is that some of the times it's they have those genes that you know that are mutated or missing or something's wrong with them. And that's how people get the disease. But for majority of those people, we have no clue. It's like 90% or more of people that have these like neurodegenerative diseases, we have no idea how they happen. We just see the effects of it.
And so we don't know what's the trigger that activates the disease.
Nope. It may be a play between the environment, it may be a play between genetics or like something mixed in between. We just don't know. And so that's like the hardest problem is like understanding like what are these genes doing like normally? If we understand how they're working in like good conditions or perfect conditions, then I think we can start piecing together what's happening when they're not working right. And these proteins, these genes, they aren't just independent things. They work like the internet where you have like different spots. They communicate and do different like tasks or different functions like in a factory. And if you have one person slacking off, you may have another person that can pick up that slack. And so then that's you start true. Getting the compensation. And it's like, wait, who just did that? It's like, you ain't supposed to do that. You're supposed to do something else. Did you just screw up your other job helping out this person? It's a big game of telephone. Yeah. And you have people on both sides of you giving you information. Sometimes that helps you, sometimes that hurts you. And so that's the kind of stuff that we have to study in order for even to get near a cure. Because, I mean, you can get, like you can treat the symptoms, but you're not treating the problem.
Right.
Like with Parkinson's, like a big thing is that, you give them dopamine back into their brains, then they'll be all right. But the problem is they're not all right. They just lost 80% of those neurons in that area that needed the dopamine. They're dead. You can't get that back. And so you're giving the cells that are living around that or those cells that need that dopamine signal just a source. But that also causes problems. It's like, it's not foolproof. That's why the medication over time starts to like give like the weird kind of shakiness of it. Because like Parkinson's is more like a stiff rigidity. But then if you keep giving dopamine, you see them shaking more and more. Like my mom is like, there are consequences because we're not fixing the problem itself. We're just treating it. And so you can live a better quality of life, but you're not treating the problem.
Right. And, you know, treating the symptoms is better than nothing, depending on your experimentation and the patient itself. I think your research you wrote a paper and recently, maybe I'm not recent, but I was looking through your work and you were working with many brains and organoids. And I think that's going to be, a path for being able to explore more on treatments. Like, and maybe it won't be drugs. Maybe it'll be, stem cells. I feel like stem cells are going to be, easier fix in a way because we might not understand the every intricate component of what each stem cell does when it's in environment of a whole organ. But instead of having to reinvent the wheel, you'll just be replacing it,
Yeah, exactly, which goes to one of the other questions, if you can, make an immortal brain. It's like, you're most likely not going to be able to build that whole brain, but you may be able to fix some of the parts. Like, infancy, but I think it's possible.
Right. Because that was the question where someone asked you, okay, if we were able to do a brain transplant, could you live, could you have immortality because you just put it in a new body over and over?
Yeah, which there are some papers that someone is going to try to do that in 2017. I don't know if it's going to go through because of the ethical issues with that, but we are way, way, way far down that line before we're going to get something successful with that. There's just too many complicated. I mean, like with my experiments, when I have to do like mouse brain dissections, that brain starts degrading instantly. It turns into mush. And so you don't have, it's really, really fast. Like, because all the proteins in there, they're used to environment. the brain has like a barrier surrounding it where you don't interact with the stuff that's in the fluid of the other body. You have like cerebrospinal fluid and blood like surrounding the area, so the brain does not get exposed. Mm-hmm. So when you like, when you cut someone's head off essentially, I mean, you're losing all those nutrients that's going to your brain. I don't know how they're going to sustain that. Yeah, the brain
I never thought about that.
Yeah, it's not surrounded like the rest of our organs. Like, they're in a, I guess, in a bath of stuff. But our brain is, like, tightly encased where it doesn't interact with stuff a lot because you got to protect that. That's, like, your central hardcore place of life right there. So you don't want to muck with that.
Mm.
So if you take off someone's head and then put it on someone else, you're not going to be guaranteed that you're going to come out the same.
Yeah.
That's what worries me, like, the most.
Yeah. Wow, that's true. I never even thought about that. I never thought about how sensitive or how quickly the brain would degenerate or degradate if it was exposed to, you know, the environment, even for like a minute or two.
I mean, it's pretty much like, I wouldn't say jello, but it's pretty darn close to it. So it turns very liquidy and smushy after like just a minute, if not less, of exposure. It's not cool. I mean, you got enzymes that we don't even think about that start digesting your brain. It's like, that ain't cool. It's quite sticky and gross, actually.
You're right.
And it ruins a lot of experiments.
Oh, that explains why the organoids and the mini brains are such a breakthrough as well, because just to have the material itself to experiment on, and especially since it's so delicate, you know?
Yeah, they put it in like juices and stuff that promote the survival of that tissue. I mean, we can grow stuff in petri dishes. It's just not going to be viable without that media, or medium as we call it. We put like all the sugars in there, we put like the amino acids, and make sure we have things that is not going to break down the tissue. Because you could do it. Like, my friend, she used to do, like, brain slice cultures where she's studying how the neurons would fire. But after an hour, that stuff is dead, even with the media. So,
wow.
If you're talking about a whole big brain, that's tough.
You're like, we're nowhere near that. We're not. But what is it people do? They do chiro something where they freeze the body, the brain, right?
Yeah, we do that a lot in the lab, too, to preserve that tissue. We either, like, put it directly on liquid nitrogen, or we, like, get the tissue out as fast as we can and put it on dry ice so that it, like, preserves it in that configuration. But as soon as you unthaw it, if you don't treat it, like, ASAP, depending on what you're studying, it's going to die. Like, for example, the, like, RNA... that dies very quickly. It's not that stable. Whereas DNA, since you have two strands, it kind of protects itself. So you can pick it out a little bit better. And then proteins, for the most part, is even better than that because they're usually in an intact structure, but they might not be in the same orientation because proteins can change shape.
That's so interesting to me. Let me check the time real quick. Oh, we're doing good on time. What was I going to ask you? So, back to what is the building block? Would you say it goes RNA, DNA, then protein, like in that components? As far as does it take RNA to turn into DNA to build a protein? This is just a question that came to mind.
It's the flip. So you have the DNA. So that's like the basic template for everything. So that's where people, like, when they're doing, like, evolutionary studies, they look at that DNA because that's the thing that's usually preserved. And so when you go from DNA to RNA, it kind of, like, makes a copy of, like, a part of that DNA. And then that copy can be fed to, like, let's say if you're, like, speaking English and you want to, like, translate that into, like, Japanese, you can have, like, a computer or somebody else, like, decoding that, like, whatever you're saying into the other language. And so that's where proteins come in. So that the DNA is like your original script. the RNA is like you make a photocopy of it. And then like the protein would be like the translator saying like, okay, this is what they were saying and this is what you need to do.
Awesome.
You can kind of think of it like that. I can't think of a better example of that right now, but it's DNA to RNA to the protein.
That's a really good example. That clarifies things for me a lot more. And I picture, I'm like, okay, so what I type into Google is my DNA, and then when Google translates my English to Japanese, translation, the literal type that comes up is the RNA. And then when someone reads it, and they go, oh, they mean what's up, like what's up, what's up. Like they have that cultural understanding of what those words mean. Then that's my protein.
Yeah, you could
I don't
see
know
it
if
like
I
that.
Overcomplicated it, but basically.
Like the protein, that's the thing that's going to communicate a lot to stuff throughout the body. Like
right.
All the chemicals that we have, like either they're little amino acids or something, which are the parts of a protein, or they're like whole proteins, like sending those signals, kind of like how antennas do for like houses to get cable and stuff or TV.
Mm-hmm.
You gotta send those signals out, and some TVs they use the same thing, like TV, whatever. Some people use like dish network, but if you have something that's like screwing up the system, like that network signal, you don't know if you're like affecting just the direct TVs, if you're affecting just the dish networks, or if you're affecting everybody.
Mm.
And that's where that whole like protein stuff can get really complicated. Because like when we were talking about the treatments, if you try to treat something, you might be screwing up with someone else's network and accidentally do something to their network that you weren't supposed to. That's why when you hear all them like drug commercials, like you can get like diarrhea, blood, stool, death, something like that. We can't control everything. Hence another thing where we're treating the symptom, not the problem.
Right. So protein is all about context then. That's what it is. Like the protein gets value from its context. Like what does protein mean in this situation? You know, what's it doing here? And so on. And it's hard to see and pinpoint what every effect is going to be. So when you do take a drug and it's treating a symptom, you'll get you might get diarrhea, or you might not get diarrhea, or you might have a heart attack, or you might not, even though they're just treating you for like sinuses, you know.
Yeah, that's the risk, because everything. See, that's the other problem with a lot of the studies is that it's usually focused on like certain type of people. And because those studies, and especially with the relationship with like minority communities, with studies that have been done in the past, Tuskegee Airmen, Henrietta Lackland, you have a distrust in the system. But we need people to do those studies because we have differences, and everything's not going to work the same. And so when you get like, especially like even with the men versus women, that we have differences. And we don't react all the time. Like they say with the estrogen hormone, that can change a lot of stuff. And so that's why a lot of studies that are done in like males, or like in the mouse studies, they're done in male mice because they believe that it's less complicated. But it's like at the same time, you need those complications to figure out what's going to work for that population.
That's true.
Yeah,
it's
a lot
goodness.
Of, yeah, like you're opening a can of worms right here. It's a
you know
lot
what?
Of stuff to go through.
I'm glad you talked about that. A lot of, you know, minorities distrust science or they distrust science research just for those reasons. You know, ethics are very important, you know, and if you don't have that population represented in the people who are actually running the experiments, making the decisions on what's ethical and what isn't, you know, you're more likely to have abuse of power, I would imagine, you know, at least historically. I myself, I have MS, you know, and I know that they're recruiting for Black people to be a part of clinical research so that they can create drugs that are, you know, more diverse so they can have a better idea of how this drug affects this population under these conditions. But I'm afraid. Like,
yeah,
I don't
no,
want,
and
I'm afraid to, like, be a part of a study because I'm afraid of the medication. I'm not taking any. I'm afraid of the side effects, and it's just a lot of unknown that makes me nervous. But part of me feels like being, you know, a part of the study, you know, could be greater good to the next person. And so it's a debate that I'm still working through. And it's something that I know a lot of people think about as well, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's a delicate balance. Like, even with my mom, she didn't want to take the medication because she heard it'll get her sicker. Which, I mean, in part, you do get extra symptoms from the other effects of the drug, but at the same time, it's still treating her main symptom, which was the Parkinson's. So it's a fine line. I mean, I've seen it, and then I've read about it, so it's... That's why we need that diversity, so we can, one, talk to those communities where we need the most intervention or the most help. We got to get that trust. Same way with the whole police stuff. You got to trust those people that's going to be working with you and open a dialogue.
Right.
So we need more people to, like, get out there, like, talk to multiple groups of people, like, figure out what their opinion is. What do they think?
Yeah.
How this might help them. How this might hurt them.
Exactly.
That's the kind of stuff we need to start.
And we need, you know, I think more outreach from and more awareness of, you know, scientists and medical professionals and teachers who are in STEM and STEAM to be engaged with the public so that there's just more trust, more openness, you know? Definitely. I have one more question, and then we'll be done. It's kind of a big question, but it's all right. I often think about, how does our brain recognize what's reality? So it's kind of a philosophical question in a way, too, but just your thoughts. Say, for instance, does the brain know the difference between someone who's sitting next to me versus someone that I'm talking to via Skype? Is there any difference at all between virtual reality and actual in-person reality when we're when the brain is just, you know, triggering?
Yeah, that's actually a good question. And at least in part, the brain can play tricks on you. Like when you
can
get
you say
all
that
those
again?
Optical, the brain can play tricks on you. Everything that you see or, like, do may not necessarily be what you think happened. Like, you can sometimes, like, put memories in someone's head that they didn't really do, but they kind of assumed it because it might be similar to something they did before. Or, like the virtual, the when you have, like, those illusions. Like, when you have that what was that, gold white dress versus blue-black dress
or
something. Where everybody and their mama was seeing like 50 million different things. It just depends on what your senses detect in that reality at that point. So, I mean, you have to rely on not just like the visuals. You actually have like, can you lean over and touch somebody? That's like another thing to say like, okay, I felt that sensation. But like, let's say it's virtual reality gets like a huge jump in technology where they can somehow stimulate your brain to think that you're touching someone even though you're not, that could help blend that virtual versus reality. So
and then
I
we're in Star
that,
Trek.
Yeah, I think there's a possibility to blend the two. I don't know if our technology is like up to par yet. But I mean there are some things that if you're not paying attention to, like you may get tricks with the brain. It just depends on how I guess, big or how aware you are with that the kind of stimulation. Like, I can't answer it 100%, but I can think of some instances of where your brain thought you saw something, but you really didn't.
Right.
So, yeah.
That's true. That's true. I wonder, I mean, it'll be once it gets to the point where you can't distinguish, you can simulate actual physical reality, and then I think things are going to get even crazier. I think it'll be good in, say, for instead of Skyping, I'll feel like I'm sitting right next to you. You know, there's people will have virtual sex that way. People will teach that way. People will do all kinds of things that way. I do think we're going that way. But it it makes me think, you know, in a philosophical way, like, but what is reality? You know, what is it really? You know? So that would be
your perception. It's all whatever senses you see, that is your reality. Like how some people can, like, hear colors or, like, see taste. That's that rewiring. It all is about that sensory information. So your reality may be completely different than someone else's reality.
I know. Freaky. So, it's creepy. But then who's, and then who's to say what's crazy or not? You know?
Exactly.
What is the standard, you know? It's very, very murky. Very murky.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And whose standard by whose standard? Who made those standards? Why is that the standard?
Yeah.
Those are the questions everyone should ask.
Exactly. On an everyday basis, right? Who said being fat is not pretty? Because I'm fat, damn it.
Yeah. I mean, back in, what was it, the 1800s, that was the end thing. Like, if you were big and plump, that means you were healthy, you were eating. Nowadays, it's the reverse. I think it's just a trend. Maybe fat will come back soon enough.
All right. I have something I do for every guest. I make your song choice a soundtrack for the show. So give me three songs that come to mind right now under pressure so that they're just your most innate thoughts. Give me three songs that you'd want to reflect you on this show.
Let's see. I'll say one, Girls' Generation, You Think. Keep in mind,
Girls'
it is in
Generation?
Korean. Yep. Apostrophe after the S, You Think.
You Think? And this is K-pop?
I don't know why. Yeah, that's a K-pop song.
Uh-huh.
Another song that just popped in my head because we just watched it was Next Too Close, which I don't know why that would relate to me, but that's our jam.
Next Too Close. Oh, from the 90s, right? Early 90s. Okay,
yep.
Cool.
From the 90s. And then my all-time favorite is Boogie Oogie Oogie from the 70s, but I think it was called Taste of Honey because that song
Boogie,
has
Oogie.
A nice taste
I love
taste
that song. Yeah, I love that song.
That was like female awesomeness with that bass guitar. I'm like, that's a chick playing it. Yes!
Yeah.
And on the guitar. Yes! No problem.
That's awesome. Very, very cool. Do you think...
My friends might hate me for that.
Why?
Like, why are you putting those weird songs up there?
No, that makes it cool. That makes it unique. It would be so cool if you can come back on the show another time when I have, like, more follow-up brain science questions.
Oh, yeah, anytime. As long as I'm free at some time, I can talk. I got plenty of time right now.
Very cool. Well, I'm going to let you go, and I look forward to talking to you again. And did you want to give a shout-out to any of your Instagram, Twitter, or how people can find you online?
Yep, you can find me on Twitter at NATWADLINGTON. That is my professional Twitter account. You can also find me on LinkedIn under Natasha Watlington, but it might be easier going the Twitter route.
And can you say, I want to put it at the end, like, this is, say your name and say, I'm on the Dope Science Show, something like that.
All right. Hey, all what's right, up,
ahead.
Fellow people? What's up? My name is Natasha Wallington, and you just heard me on the Dope Science Show. Have a good day, y'all.
Awesome. Thank you so much, and I will connect with you on Twitter after.
Awesome. No problem.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, thank you guys for listening. Wasn't that fun? That was such a great episode. This is so fun. If you guys have any other questions and you want to add to the show, please hit me in the comments, ideally on iTunes. That would be great. Or on Twitter at The Dope Science Show. Actually, on Twitter, it's just at Dope Science Show. You can hit me up on Instagram. I have my email, thedopescienceshow@gmail.com. All right, so on the next episode, we get to talk to a really cool guy named Dr. Paul McNeil. He's 26. He's got a PhD in computer science. He is young, black, and awesome. And he calls himself One Cool Blurred online. And he is the real Dwayne Wayne from A Different World. We bond on that. We love A Different World. So check that episode out next, and I will talk to you soon.